This is Native Voices United Radio, the radio station with the Indigenous perspective.
Welcome to the show, Sutter.
I appreciate you having me on.
So can you give us a little background about yourself, and then I want to talk about some political issues, and we'll dive into some deep topics that have really been perking the interest of many of our families on the East Coast.
Well, I was born in Ontario, Canada. That's where my mother is from. But my parents had already been living in South Florida prior to that. My mom just wanted me to be born where she was from. So they drove up from South Florida when she was 8.5 months pregnant. I was born. And then when I was 2 or 3 weeks old, they came straight back down to South Florida. So I grew up the first 18 years of my life there. My grandfather's an enrolled member of the Mobile Band of Choctaw Indians. I am as well. My father passed away on December 25th of 1978, and the Mobile Choctaw Contemporary Roll was created in 1979. And that's why my grandfather was on the roll and my father wasn't, because he was deceased prior to that roll coming to be. I'm also of Scottish-Canadian ancestry. The Mobile Band of Choctaw Indians is a reservation-based community in Southwest Alabama. I live in Southwest Oklahoma now with my wife, who's Kiowa. She's a Kiowa tribal member. She's also Ponca as well in terms of descent, and her father is Ponca. So, you know, our tribal community in Alabama is of mixed tribal heritage, Choctaw, Cherokee, some Creek and Chickasaw descent, as well as non-Indian descent down there. So that's kind of kind of my background in terms of my upbringing and identity. The community I grew up in, though, was Hispanic and Black, and that's where many of my closest friends and allies have been from and emanated from in my life to this day.
Okay. So in the community that you grew up in, you got along with basically everybody then.
Everybody. Completely.
Yeah.
Like embarrassingly so. I was the homecoming king in high school, and that's pretty embarrassing to say that. You know what I mean? So strike against me for sure.
Well, when you grow up in a diverse background, because I know the Latin community is very diverse. I grew up in Detroit, Southwest Detroit. All the Indian kids, all the Black kids, all the Latino kids, we all hung out and played together with Armenian kids and people from all over. That neighborhood was just like the melting pot.
Right,
so everybody, there was always somebody, and in our school, we celebrated the culture of everyone. So we would bring dishes in from, grandma, what grandma would make. And one day out of the week, we'd share that with everybody. And we do little festivals that would celebrate culture and heritage, like Culture and Heritage Week or whatever. And we'd have festivals and share food, and our parents would bring in food and stuff like that. So I got to meet a lot of different kids and eat a lot of different foods, because we had kids from Nicaragua all the way down to Argentina. So when you say the Black Hispanic, the Latino community, I know exactly what you mean, because that's where I grew up too. And it's like Indian kids, mixed Indian kids, just fit in the community perfectly. And you have lots of different friends, and different people will tell you about their culture and share on Culture Day. So I can say my parents had the right frame of mind when they sent me to that school.
I really enjoyed, we were down there. The reason we ended up in South Florida is because my dad ran a drug syndicate. He had 25 guys under him, and my dad ended up getting killed when I was younger, when he was actually in the midst of a transportation, and he was transporting drugs at the time, and with a few of his colleagues. And so that was kind of the way, that's how I ended up in South Florida. And then my mom, she just didn't leave. My parents were already divorced by the time I was 2. So, well before my dad passed on. So that we just stayed, here's my mom from rural Canada, and she's living in South Florida. You know what I mean? And so that,
I know that was a huge change.
Yeah, for her, for sure. Yeah, absolutely. And I think, the optic, the community I grew up in, which is, predominantly of Cuban descent, they taught me to have a voice, right? I grew up in I grew up in Mastic Trailer Park. Mario Pipiera was he was the patriarch of the trailer park, and he nicknamed me when I was little teeny, when I was an infant. He nicknamed me Dirty Little Cuban, and it just stuck. And I'm the only kid in the community that has no Cuban descent, probably. But that's what. You know what I mean? And so you know, I didn't know any different. I didn't know any different. Those were my people. That they continue to be my people, the people I grew up with. I consider myself, mm-hmm. you know, very much a part of that community. We go back all the time. So yeah, I was very fortunate in that way. I was, you know, probably doted on a little bit by some of the community members. They took good care of me, I believe, and were kind to me. And so I really, mm-hmm. you know, appreciate that about them. And, you know, imagine now a guy who's non-Hispanic being called Dirty Little Cuban. Like, I could never announce that, you know? Like, that would be...
You're right.
You know what I mean? Like, the tag of cultural appropriation would be so intense. But, of course, I never publicly announced it. It was something that was called to me as opposed by me. So it was just one of those things. It was one of those things. And they meant it endearingly. They certainly couldn't look 40 years into the future and see how that would play out.
Well, but see, by growing up in a diverse community, from what I've experienced is you can, you know, reach out to different communities and be able to understand them, and communicate. And, you know, when you're sitting down and having dinner with somebody and they're telling you about their problems or whatever is going on in the community, you understand because you live there and you know how the people are.
Absolutely.
So,
yeah. Big part
when
of
when I see, and you have to, I mean, I like the creator just makes people like us so that we can get along and talk to so many different people and be able to interact with them. In my mind, I see myself as somebody like that because I can interact with people in Iraq and, you know, all across the world and feel right at home and comfy doing it, you know?
Absolutely. No, for sure. I wouldn't change anything. I feel very fortunate, you know, even, you know, having a father who did the things he did, I still feel fortunate the place where I grew up, the community I grew up around. I feel fortunate in my experience after my first year in college, moving up to Canada, spending a lot of time with my mom's mother, my grandma. I wasn't raised with that side of my family, so it was a learning experience for me, getting to know everybody and those kind of things. And it was just a blessing. You know, it was a big change, but a good change. I get to meet, you know, people from the reserves all around the area there and spent a lot of time and, you know, just became, you know, connected, interconnected as family. And I wouldn't change a bit of it.
So, and you spent how much time here in Canada?
So I moved to Canada. I was, let me see, must have just been turning 20 or about to turn 20 when I moved to Canada. And I was all the way there until 2001. I left in 2001, moved up there in 94.
Okay, you were here for a nice little time frame then.
Yeah, I lived up there for 7 years. Six to seven years I lived up there, yeah.
I lived in Little Rock, Arkansas for 6 years. So 6 years is a nice, 6-7 years is a nice time frame. You get to know the community pretty well.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure you, that's when you met Bruce, right?
What now? That's
when
what?
You were here, you met Bruce?
Yes,
at school.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we met up there. And my mom's community is not far from Moraviantown. So.
Okay.
Yeah, and I taught school at Walpole Island First Nation at the Kedgewanong there. And I was also a school teacher at Hillside School in Stoney and Kettle Point. And then also I was in the, you know, I did tutoring programs and stuff at Amjanong at Chippewasasarnia First Nation. That's where we lived. We lived on the Chippewasasarnia First Nation, which is called Amjanong. So lived there and also lived on the Hiawatha First Nation near Rice Lake, near the Peterborough area. So lived up there as well. And then we did a lot of community activity and work on the Six Nations res up there as well, Six Nay. So we, kind of moved around in that whole southern, southwestern Ontario area, southern Ontario area.
Well, and some of the things that you've experienced, I mean, I would like you to share some of the things. And I know tonight, one of the topics that, you know, I spoke with you about earlier, don't feel shy to dive in, because we want to hear everything that you have to share with us so we can help the people in the community, and not be afraid to stand up and things like that. Just give us some background on what's happened to you in Indian Country when you've been confronted with some of these people.
Yeah, we can. I mean, we can even talk in larger terms, you know, about that.
Mm-hmm.
Just know so many people who have been impacted as well by all the identity politics and blood policing that goes on in Indian Country. And for me, it started as a freshman. I'm at Marymount University in Arlington, Virginia, right across the Potomac from Washington, D.C. Got to know a mm-hmm. lot of the Mattapani and Pamunkey, Rappahannock, and others, Virginia tribes there. I had no idea what state or federal recognition was. Indians were just Indians to me. Like, I didn't know about all these politics. And getting to know them, I learned that these individuals had gone to boarding schools with my relatives. My family being mm-hmm. Choctaw Indians on my paternal side. So I didn't, you know, boarding schools are boarding schools. I mean, Indians go to Indian boarding schools, right? Like, that's where you go.
Mm-hmm.
So the mm-hmm. idea that you were somehow not Indian, well, then how could you have been sent 600 to 1,100 miles away to an Indian boarding school if you're not Indian? And for that to have happened mm-hmm. generationally. See, that this mm-hmm. is where it got confusing for me. And so they said, well, we're not recognized. And then I started to learn about the politics. And the first thing that I knew right away, now this is coming from a guy who was not raised in a white or American Indian community, right? So the mm-hmm. first thing I noticed inherently was this was about anti-blackness. It was very clear.
Mm-hmm.
So I started doing these surveys. And I can share, I just had a piece called Indian Country's Apartheid, published by Duke University Press in June of 2020. And so in there, and I'm looking in the book right now, in my section, it's an anthology work. And one of the things, you know, when I'm looking at this, I saw of 29 federal tribes listed in the East and South, and this is something that I just published last year, only six are those that media and publications have painted as having some black ancestry. The remaining 23 have been designated as Indian, Indian white, or white in media or publications. Some of the federal tribes listed did not reside on reservations until after receiving federal recognition and then taking land into federal trust. Some of the federal tribes did not have a single member who attended an Indian boarding school, unlike many of the quote-unquote non-federal tribes. And yes, this matters greatly to the powers that be, as Indian boarding school attendance has now been enshrined in the new federal recognition regulation, and many academics, including all those mentioned previously in this piece I did, have used attendance at such schools as authenticators, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then you flip it around. Of the six federally recognized tribes as of 2016, that were perceived to have some black ancestry, all have only been recognized since the 1980s. So what you're saying is all of the federal tribes were non, quote unquote, perceived to be or having black ancestry. It was only through a couple congressional acts and federal lawsuits that forced and over $30 million plus for a couple of these tribes in gaming backing that forced this through the system. So they were not really wanted. Let's put it that way. Now,
mm-hmm.
we just did the 29 that are federal. So of the 30 historic non-federal tribes, and there are some others, so I'm not in any way cutting names out here, listed in the East
mm-hmm.
and South pre-2018, though most are recognized by state governments, where the tribal lands exist, all have been typecast as having black ancestry. So of the 30, all of those have been typecast as being perceived or having black ancestry. That's not a coincidence that the federally recognized tribes are perceived and have white ancestry for the most part, and the exact almost equivalent number, a 29 to 30 split, don't have recognition and they're all perceived to be of black ancestry, right? Nobody can
mm-hmm.
say that's a coincidence. Because it's not a coincidence.
No.
And so this is the reality. When you're talking about the Lumbees, when you're talking about the Halawasaponis, right? When you're talking about the Nanticokes, when you're talking about the Nanticoke Lenni Lenape in New Jersey, when you're talking about the Moaband and Choctaw Indians, and we can keep, when you're talking about the Uncochug in Long Island, when you're talking about the Shinnecock who had to spend over $30 million to finally get themselves pushed through, right, into this process.
Mm-hmm.
We know the reason that they've been held up. We know the reason they've been held up. And so one of the things that we also know is this, and this was a seminal moment for me when I'm talking to a representative for the Lumbee and they share this with me, and then I actually get the actual document, the original document.
Mm-hmm.
Gary Anderson and Kirk Kickingbird, who's Kiowa, an attorney, were hired by the National Congress for American Indians to research this issue of federal recognition in 1978, okay, by the National Congress mm-hmm. for American Indians. And they were supposed to present a paper on their findings to the National Conference on Federal Recognition, which was being held in Nashville, Tennessee at the time. Their paper, called An Historical Perspective on the Issue of Federal Recognition and Non-Recognition, closed with the following statement. The reasons that are usually presented to withhold recognition from tribes are, one, that they are racially tainted with the blood of African tribesmen, or two, greed, for newly recognized tribes will share in the appropriations for services given to the Bureau of Indian Affairs. The names of justice, mercy, sanity, common sense, fiscal responsibility, and rationality can be presented just as easily on the side of those advocating recognition. This is from 1978. This is when the new office, which was then the Bureau of Acknowledgement and Research, the new federal recognition process was beginning. And so you have a full-blood Kiowa attorney from a federal tribe saying, now don't get me wrong, that's very dated language to say the least, African tribesmen, as opposed to saying black and or African American, right? But that's mm-hmm. what it was in 1978. And he's making very yeah. clear, they did a very in-depth research project on this whole position and the positionalities of all these communities and why they're trying to stop these people and so forth. And this is exactly what the facts are. So now we're going back 43 years. There's been no change in this. And the performative nature since this last March, primarily because of Black Lives Matter, the performative nature now of some people in Indian country claiming allyship with the black community, when I know factually, living here in Oklahoma, many of these same individuals that are now claiming an allyship or an alliance are the same individuals who are disparaging people of mixed black descent within Indian country. So it's completely performative. Mm-hmm. But, and so it's, you know, my wife and I, our family, we also attend a black church as well as an American Indian church, have for many, many years. And so we make sure that the black community understands fully that many of these individuals are just being performative to them. They are not genuinely mm-hmm. concerned about them. They are just in the moment right now. Right. And they want to conflate and push out ideas of racial prejudice towards the black community by talking about sovereignty. Well, it's our sovereign right to make a decision. But sovereignty has nothing to do with holding prejudicial tendencies towards other people. That's not what sovereignty
exactly.
is. And so that's a big thing for me. And it really bleeds over into when you look at the Office of Federal Acknowledgement. And so Lee Fleming, of course, he is a white phenotype, and I claim myself to be white phenotype. I feel that my phenotype is very, you know, closely resembling, you know, the white ancestry of my family. And I have claimed that since the very beginning of my life. And I mm-hmm. think that with Lee Fleming, he was raised in affluence on the East Coast, far away from the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma. He is a citizen of the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma, but he certainly doesn't present that way, and so he has that privilege. That he has for, you know, being viewed as a white person for most intents and purposes. And so even though he's a citizen, he became the head of the Bureau of Acknowledgement and Research. And so he was working on our federal recognition bill as well as everybody else's. And so he was also a part of this Cherokee group, which became the Cherokee mm-hmm. Task Force, which was used to disempower and to marginalize historic non-federal tribal communities. This is a part of their mission, right? And so mm-hmm. what he ended up doing was, when he was working on our case, I want to read you the exact letters from one of the conferences he was at Samford University in Alabama, at a genealogical
okay.
conference. All right. One such case is illustrated by his denial of my own tribe's federal recognition petition initially in 1999. Hearing of this denial, Professor Don Rankin recounted a disturbing incident by letter to the leadership of the Moravana Choctaw Indians concerning statements made at a June 1995 genealogy seminar conducted by Sharon Scholars Brown at Samford University in Alabama. Arlie Fleming was also a presenter at the conference, and 1 year later he joined the Bureau of Acknowledgement and Research, Office of Federal Acknowledgement, within the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Dr. Rankin's letter states, "Someone brought up the Moa Choctaw in their attempt at federal recognition. At this stage, several people had gathered around and were talking. Ms. Brown responded in an even professional tone of voice that she felt that they would not be successful. When asked why, she responded that the Moa Choctaw had black ancestors and, in her opinion, were not Indian. Mr. Lee Fleming, who was at that time the tribal registrar for the Western Band of Cherokee," they put in there, "the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma, and one of the lecturers," mm-hmm, agreed with her. I was shocked at their statements." So now you have a person ruling on a federal recognition petition that had been languishing for ages, right? It had taken all the way till 1999. Can you imagine? From 1978. It had taken all the way till 1999 to even be heard. And the individual who was now responsible for the decision is the individual who a year previously was calling our community black and invalid and inauthentic as an indigenous community. So all of this has been submitted over and over and over again. All of the verifiable proof, we've sent in all the verifiable proof that other federal tribes use lobbyists, spent over $15 million fighting our federal petition, and that Jack Abramoff, a noted D.C. lobbyist, spent 6 years. He got a 6-year prison sentence for his role in manufacturing the marginalization and the upending of our federal petition. It's all completely documented. There's no, you know, theories about this. There's nothing. This is all Open Records Act. This is all heavily documented, consistently sent to the Department of the Interior and the Bureau of Indian Affairs showing this and having no response. So we already know that other indigenous communities in the East Coast are enduring the same prejudicial treatment over and over and over again. Our community members have attended Haskell, mm-hmm, Macomb, Acadia. The list goes on and on. 6 boarding schools. As the Lumbees attended Carlisle, for instance. Palawasa Pony, yeah, attended Macomb. Nanticokes attended Haskell. We're spent over 1,000 miles from home. And the reason is our communities were not allowed to attend the non-Indian schools in our area. And so we were sent, yeah, to the schools that we legally could attend, which were Indian schools, because our people are Indians. And that's, yeah, it. It's so clear cut. And so if anyone goes to
helphaskell.org. It's very clear cut.
It's very clear cut. So they go to helphaskell.org. They go onto our website and they can see well over 1,000 documents showing the yearbook photos of our people at the boarding schools, showing the grade records, showing not only did we attend the schools, but yes, we also were the homecoming queens, our people. Our people also were the star quarterbacks on the Indian boarding school football team. And, you know, we were integral, mm-hmm, parts of these places. We were pillars to these spaces. And so the idea now that we can be removed, it comes down to that quote, the things people use against you in life are the things they most fear themselves. This is about their insecurities. It's not about our realities. And it's unfortunate.
So it is unfortunate. Now, when the problems came with the Michigan Indian Tuition Waiver, because they did something where they enshrined it in the Constitution that this thing about race couldn't be used in Michigan. At the same exact time that was going on, I remember finding the Help Haskell website. And I reached out to you a couple of times. We just kept missing each other, but the long run was we were winning in court all the way up until we got to the Supreme level, the Supreme Court,
right,
and then we lost that case. But even so, it still made me, you know, dig. I wanted to find out what was going on. How come the kids, weren't able to go back to Haskell? You know, I really wanted to understand what was going on. Why weren't these non-federally recognized communities able to go to the Indian schools anymore? Right. So what happened with that? It was a court case that changed everything, right? With about fiduciary duty?
Yeah. And so it wasn't even a court case. So what happened was Ross Swimmer, who, like Arlie Fleming with the Office of Federal Acknowledgement, is an enrolled citizen of the Cherokee Nation. Okay. And so he was, mm-hmm. you know, one of the heads of the Department of Interior, Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs, all those things. He could see that his people were no longer meeting the blood quantum requirement to attend the school of a quarter blood. So as our people mm-hmm. were meeting that, and our people are documented as having that, and this is not blood politics for me. I could care less about blood quantum. I believe in community cohesion. I believe in sincere reciprocity within our communities. I believe that the door is open to all of our people to learn, to experience, to participate within our tribal community. That's what I believe. Mm-hmm. I believe in that family ethic of how we identify ourselves as communities. I don't believe
yes.
in this idea of blood quantum, but at the same time, I do understand the irony that a community like the Nanticoke, who are clearly listed as a being more than a quarter Indian ancestry as per the blood designations given by the Bureau of Indian Affairs when they attended schools like Haskell, how can they be removed? But people now that are 1/1000th in something, when I attended Haskell, one of my classmates, he showed me his CDIB. He was 1/1024, Cherokee. He's a great guy, super sincere, wonderful human being. Nothing, I couldn't say a negative thing about him, but I can still see the irony, right? The irony mm-hmm. is clear, is that how does this person have access when the others don't? So what Ross Swimmer did was he created a memo, and I can send you guys a copies of all of these things. He just literally created a memo. And the memo enabled his tribal members. So this was about his members of which they now call themselves citizens, and some have previously called themselves citizens, so that could be a long-winded debate as well. But those individuals could not attend, and so he opened the door. And he made sure that they could through a memo. Well, this is what the Native American Rights Fund said. They came on as a pro bono advocate for myself. They did extensive research, met with heads of the Bureau of Indian Education through this process, met with all the heads of Haskell, with the then seated president and others. They had very substantive meetings with them and substantive research. The Native American Rights Fund found, after thoroughly examining the issue and meeting with representatives from the BIA, that former Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs and Cherokee Nation citizen Ross Swimmer's memorandum, which expelled historic non-federal, generationally attending Indian boarding school tribes from Haskell, in particular, despite them all having 1/4 or more Indian blood quantums listed by the BIA and BIE, was unlawful. NARF's final communication on the matter was sent to me on May 23, 2016. It reads, "It appears to NARF that when the Bureau changed Haskell Indian Nations University admissions policy in the late 1980s, the agency did not follow the procedures that are required under the APA, Administrative Procedure Act, when a federal agency makes a rule change or decision of this type." That's it. It was unlawful.
So,
and the largest legal advocacy group, the largest group of legal attorneys in Indian country, stated
mm-hmm.
that it was completely unlawful. But because Haskell and the BIE is in such a space of underfunding, dysfunction, constant rule change, constant leadership change, they've used that since 2016 to not advance the issue and not do what's right by law.
Oh my gosh.
It's a smoke screen.
So, okay. Now, I understand why the Michigan Indian Tuition Waiver didn't move forward. Because mm-hmm. of the law, it was enshrined into the Constitution, and, you know, it was separate than what was going on out at Haskell. And I mm-hmm. thought that there was a court case. Well, not even a court case. There was a Supreme Court ruling about a fiduciary duty and going to school, going to an Indian school would be one of those things that would show, you know, that you were an Indian kid because you went to
right.
an Indian school. Or right. going to the Urban Indian Center and getting health care under the Urban Indian Center would show that you're Indian because you got health care services from the
Absolutely.
Urban Indian Center.
Right.
Now, when I went, you know, I thought this is what this Haskell thing came out of. I thought this was all a part of fiduciary responsibility, and they wanted to scrub, you know, Haskell clean of any of the non-federal kids because they didn't want to be responsible for them.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was strictly a memorandum.
Wow.
A literal one-page memo, which I'll send you a copy of. It's incredible that they changed the entire. And so what they're saying is, you know, and this is the problem, like at Haskell, because I'm a Haskell alumni, right? So one of the problems is that we have to believe in this idea of institutional integrity. And for an institution to have any level of integrity, then they have to follow the rules that they put in place. And so what they've done is they had an individual who has this long-standing grievance. Many of these citizens of the Cherokee Nation have this grievance, Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma, have this grievance, which is really unfortunate, you know. And one of the things that is really odd is that on my reservation in Alabama, we have numerous Cherokee Nation citizens that live there. Numerous. Mm-hmm. We have over 30 federal tribes that are intermarried in our community, our small community. So our kids are a mix of all sorts of tribes. It's hard to find. There's not, I can tell you, not even hard to find. It's impossible to find a family in my community that does not have a family member who, or multiple family members who are also enrolled in federal tribes. It's almost impossible, right? And so how do the Cherokee citizens that live on our reservation that have been intermarried with us going all the way back, we were started attending in boarding schools, right, in the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s. How did they feel about their spouses and grandchildren and great-grandchildren being called these things and being called, you know, the term mulatto in a negative way, being called black in a way that's to disparage, not to uplift, right? So this is what happens, you know, when it gets to the point where, I was – recently in the national news because I was doing a presentation for the university I was working for on colorism, racism, you know, college upliftment, all these things. I've done this presentation many, many times. I've been a long-term teacher in all black schools with all black administrations, and a non-black Cherokee citizen who does not like me then convinced two black teenagers that I shouldn't be talking about skin color or hair texture. And then I was on the national news as a racist towards the black community, and I was called a white educator. So, So no matter what you do, they will always contort the narrative. And so what I had to make a decision, I had 5 minutes to make a decision in my life, right? I had to choose between reputation or character. Because reputation blows through the wind and it blows through the internet. But your character is one of the few things in your life you can control yourself. Mm-hmm. And so I could go out and disparage the university I worked for, which was a, you know, almost all white institution in terms of the administrative level. We had one person of color, a black male, who was in the administrative level of all of the individuals there. And I could have said how ironic they were for joining this national narrative now because they wanted to, quote unquote, save face. When all these news reporters were showing up at our house and doing these kind of things, and then I'm speaking to them because you can't say no, but then you're condemned. And then they're editing out 95% of what I'm discussing and pushing it back to the narrow white. See, so this is how the game works. Then Good Morning America, I'm supposed to be on their show, which I have no interest in being on anything like this. It's so childish, this whole, well, I shouldn't even say childish. It's so adultish because children tend to have more maturity a lot of the time than a lot of adults do. And so they're supposed to be on at whatever time in the morning. The phone call doesn't come. I'm supposed to be on the Zoom. And so I call them so they don't think I'm dodging them. And they said, Mr. Sunray, we've decided not to do the piece. And I was like, that's wonderful, but, you know, why? Well, we actually did some research on your background, and it seems you're actually the opposite. You have over 30 published articles on anti-blackness. You grew up and lived for many years in black communities. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You come from a tribe. That is, blah, 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 blah. You understand what I'm saying? And So what I told them was, so you go out and disparage and attempt to destroy somebody, and then you research them. So that's what we do, right? This is what we do in the vitriolic internet world. we don't spend any time caring about people and being sincere, what we do is we just go for people's throats because we have another agenda that the mainstream media won't see, but we can use the mainstream media to placate, you know, to go after and to do these sorts of things. And this is just what happens. It's become common experience. And so for me, I'm a full-time school teacher. I work full-time in the public school system. I've been an educator for over 20 years. The thing for me is this is what I teach my kids every day in school. I teach them to become internet immune, to become vitriol immune. This is, to me, one of the most important lessons they can have, because I see our young people, high rates of suicide, as we all know, right? I see our young people, devastating body image, all these sorts of things that they're going through. And so there's many of us educators. I mean, you all are educators, you know, in your way of doing things. We're all collectively trying to stop that hurtfulness. We're all collectively, and the only way we can do it is if we're willing to take some bullets ourselves. People can say anything they want about me. It's fine. You know, I'm grown. I have an incredible wife, wonderful kids, a beautiful family, a tribal community who I'm, you know, so lovingly engaged in. And we just have to be able to take some bullets. And we have to understand that the people slinging those bullets, they're hurt. Mm-hmm. They've been traumatized. They've suffered in all kinds of ways themselves, and they don't know how to express it in a healthy way. And so what they want to do is release their insecurities on others. And that's really how I feel about the whole situation.
Now, when it comes to the youth, what do you feel we should be saying to the youth when it comes to helping their communities right now with all that's going on? Because, you know, it's polarized right now.
Yeah, it's very polarized, you know, especially – you know, where we live here in Oklahoma. As you know, Oklahoma, during the Obama era, with President Obama, this was the only state that in both election cycles, not a single county voted in majority for Barack Obama. So we're the only one. So Oklahoma is the reddest of the reddest states. And many members of tribes here in Oklahoma are completely conservative Republicans, mm-hmm. and very much sit on that side. So it's not just a white-black issue, right? It's also mm-hmm. a red-white issue here in Oklahoma. And then you'll have an more academic elite who are indigenous, who pronounce this idea of alliance and togetherness, but the reality of their own communities in large part is not accepting of what that university level talk is, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So you have they're just completely separate spaces. You know, people that have access to media and so forth are saying, you know, we stand in solidarity, but then the reality is on the ground, that's not really how it looks. But I tell my students all the time, I just said it again this week, and, you know, in one full day of classes, I said the most dangerous mm-hmm. things in education are the things we're unwilling to discuss. So that's the message to our youth all the time, is we have to be able to have the discussion. We have to be able to say, and this is so hard. You know, we were just at a church, you know, wonderful human being, great friend of mine. He's a pastor at one of the black churches on the northeast side of Oklahoma City. So we were just at church, you know, on Sunday. And one of the things I've always so appreciated about him, besides many things I appreciate about him, is that he wants to have honest conversations. And so when my son, who's now a high school student, when he was in elementary school and they were doing a week on Martin Luther King, and right by where we live here is Martin Luther King Expressway, and then in the community I grew up in, we have Martin Luther King Community Center as well as Frederick Douglass Community Center. Those were our two community centers. But the teacher's talking about all these things, all these wonderful things Martin Luther King Jr. did during the Civil Rights Movement. And so my son raised his hand. He said, but you didn't mention that he cheated on his wife a lot. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're supposed to not have that conversation, because even though it's real and it's honest, we like to saint people. There's people that have become untouchable. So if we have a conversation about systemic violence and systemic racism, like I was doing to these news outlets, and they cut all that part out because that didn't fit the narrative they were trying to produce. The narrative was this white guy comes in here talking about nappy heads. You see what I'm saying? So this was the right. So this was the narrative that they needed to assuage their guilt, their own white guilt in these news, you know, in these news outlets. But we're not having that conversation. We're not discussing when we're having protests down the road in Minneapolis, justified protests, when the communities, all these communities are banding together and saying this has to stop, that exactly four blocks down the road, there are 20 black individuals beating up a trans black person. And calling them all kinds of homophobic slurs. And that part that's filmed and very visual is suppressed in the news because it doesn't fit the narrative. So the narrative goes all different ways. And I bring that up to say that's how this looks as well. You know, we're talking about identity policing. What's happening is these people that are identity policing, they're the same individuals that are saying this about these types of individuals, and they're conflating it with extreme cases. They're saying, well, two white guys are in California claiming to be from some Cherokee group, and they've gotten millions of dollars in federal grants for their businesses. They're trying to make it sound like that in any way, shape, or form could connect itself to being a Nanticoke or being a Moliban Choctaw or being a Lumbee. They're trying to conflate things that are completely unrelated to say this is why we need to stop this, right? They're talking about people who are selling sweat lodge ceremonies and hurting people in these sweat, and then they're trying to conflate it with historic, recognizable, clearly cohesive indigenous communities, many of whom happen to be on both the east and west coasts, right? Because half of the tribes in California are not fairly recognized either.
Yeah.
So this is, it's that conflation, and what that is called extremism. That's all it is. It's no different than the person that bombs a building in Oklahoma City who's an extremist. It's no different than all these edges, because that was physical and true death and violence, correct? But we have young people in our communities, our historic non-federal communities, whose own lives they've taken because of the way they're talked about, the way they're discussed, the way they've been generationally marginalized, right? And they are a part of that suicide epidemic that has reached our communities and hurt our communities. These are not words that do not have genuine contribution to those passings. These are violent words. And that's why there's no backing down from this. That's why we have to stay firm, because we have to uplift our young people. We got to stay invested in it, and we got to take some bullets for them. Like I said earlier, sometimes we just got to take some bullets. You know?
That's the truth.
Because we have to have the wherewithal as adults to be able to take that. I can tell you many of these people who identity police. I know many of them. And I know their backgrounds. You know, I know what's happened in their lives. I know the ones who were raised completely within the non-Indian culture, whose both parents phenotypically meet that standard of whiteness, and who in college transformed themselves more so into somebody that had this strong inclination to their federal tribal communities that through descent they were able to become enrolled with. I know ones who have enrolled themselves first and then gone back and enrolled their moms and their grandparents and then said, see, all my generations are enrolled, but they didn't tell us the trajectory in which the enrollment happened. It didn't happen from grandparent down to grandchild. It happened from grandchild up to grandparent. And there's a difference.
Yeah, I know some Indian people that come out of Oklahoma, but they're originally from the East Coast and went all the way to Oklahoma. And their tribe, when it was reorganized, it was just the grandpa that was involved, and the kids were never involved in any of the politics. They never enrolled in the tribe, and they're still not enrolled in the tribe. So I can understand what you're saying.
Sure. And it's not – that doesn't inauthenticate their family. That's not what it is. But what it's – again, it's asking the question, how can they be the ones policing others, right? This is always the question.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the questions I ask in this paper. How is it possible that tribes residing on recognized Indian reservations or who attended Indian boarding schools operated by the federal government in closely related missions or who were prevented from attending white or black schools during the segregation period or a combination of these could not be recognized by the federal government? How is it possible that tribes for whom the federal government listed blood quantums when they sent their members to Indian boarding schools, when the requirement for enrollment was a minimum of 1/4 Indian blood, could not be recognized today? Right? I mean, these are the constant questions. And then it even goes more. So if you're from one of the East Coast tribes who didn't attend the Indian boarding schools, guess what? The chances are, though, you didn't attend the non-Indian schools either. You were given a quote-unquote Indian school that you could only attend. Right? You were the other. This whole other designation. You were the red bone. You were the Melungeon. You were the mulatto. You were the Cajun spelled with two A's, not with a U. You were these names. You were the Dominicker, right? You were the Jackson White. You were all these other names that they've created to identify a community that they certainly didn't want to provide indigenous rights to after feeling like they've removed them all to the West already. They didn't want them messing up their municipalities and their county governance systems and these things. And so you were given these other names. But what those names said were, you were not white, right? And so if you were not white, then you joined this reality of systemic racism. And then you now have people who are predominantly white and a few of their brown tribal members in their tribes who are now running this burnt earth policy of Indian identity across the country and attempting to hurt and belittle others.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all come out of this, you know, and it's really unfortunate. I mean, what else can be said about it? It's just really in terms of how unfortunate it is. I mean, I look at ours when they're reviewing. This is one of the, you know, one of the craziest stories. So Kevin Gover, who's Pawnee, right? And he became the Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs. Well, that's when our petition was coming up. Right when he came on, they had to make a decision. He had been on the job for exactly 2 days. And Arlie Fleming, who wanted to get rid of us, asked him to sign off on the denial. Now, he'd only been on the job 2 days, which means he never reviewed any of it. He went on Lee Fleming's word, denies our tribe, and then when he ends up leaving the Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs, he goes in front of Congress, and you can pull it up in the record here, on April 21st, 2004, he provided testimony before the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs on proposed Senate Bill 297. In his testimony addressing the structural issues with the federal acknowledgement program, Gover provided the following statement. First, I strongly believe that certain petitioners which already have been denied recognition should be permitted another opportunity under the revised process established by this bill. Into this category, I would place Moa Choctaw. Right?
Mm.
I mean, this is what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and it's just...
he reviewed us after the fact and found that clearly we were an Indian community. Census record after census record lists us as Indian. And Lee Fleming carefully picked out the census records that listed our people as mulatto, white, or black, the smaller number, and those were the ones that he put in as proof to deny our petition.
Right. Awful. That is really awful. That is
also, they
terrible.
Said our Indian boarding school records were received, quote-unquote, out of time, and our language tapes, where our elders are speaking our traditional language, were also, quote-unquote, received out of time. How convenient, right? That the clearest of identifiers were somehow received out of time. I mean, this is, and all these communities are going through this, and I've seen a lot of tribes on the East Coast where they come in and they say, oh, well, they don't have their tribal language. And so my response to them is this. So you're saying your tribe, who's Havasupai, Navajo, Cherokee, Creek, Assiniboine, and so forth and so on, you're saying you do have some speakers of the language. Obviously you do. I've been to your communities. I know that to be true. And so when exactly were you contacted? Oh, wait a minute. You weren't contacted in the 1600s? You weren't run over for 300 years, 200 years? You were the ones that were hit last.
Mm-hmm.
Of course there's going to be a semblance of retention of your language because you weren't run over first. You weren't run over first. When a running back gets tackled, there's already been five linemen that have been hit before someone ever gets to the running back. Right? Look at the livelihood of the linemen, how many years many of them last. The constant. And so we have this idea, we want to look at all, we want to create this federal recognition process that's a one-size-fits-all federal recognition process that doesn't deal with the reality of the historical context.
Mm-hmm.
And then we want to infuse anti-black racism into the mix. Well, that's, of course, we know where that's going to work out. It's not going to work out.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't.
And it seems like you know, there's these pop-up people. They seem like they're like these gatekeepers in Indian country. And what they do is it seems like they just want to wear people down so that they won't try to go for federal recognition or assert themselves as Native Americans.
Absolutely. But like I said earlier, they keep conflating extreme examples of misusing a system or making claims, and they conflate it with these historic communities, these clearly marginalized communities, these clearly indigenous communities that have so many quote-unquote trappings of what exemplifies any indigenous community, not only here in the United States or in Canada or in Mexico, but throughout the world.
Yeah.
The interrelatedness, the ways that our communities are even interwoven like baskets. The way that when you come to my community, we have 12 primary surnames. Right? I mean, everybody knows everybody. These are not communities.
Yeah.
These are not large corporate entities like the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma, which now has about 400,000 tribal members. 400,000.
Wow, that's a lot.
400,000.
That's a lot of tribal members.
Sure. And so one of the questions I asked, my tribe has 3,600, right? So I think the Nantigos have like 1,000 or 1,200 or so. If I'm off on that, I apologize. But, I mean, when we're talking about our communities, you know, I can go into Tahlequah, Oklahoma, into the Indian Health Service, and literally have seen this for myself, guys with red beards, freckles, wearing the Confederacy T-shirts, sitting in there getting their Indian Health Service because they're a citizen of the Cherokee Nation.
Mm-hmm.
I can see when I go there, we lived there when they were trying to remove the Cherokee Freedmen. And so immediately, like many others, I was just one of many, stood up on behalf of the Cherokee Freedmen and said, whoa, we're with you. This is insane. How can they be removing you when I got a guy with a Confederacy shirt sitting right next to my kids in the Indian Health Service getting services, right?
That's right.
Like, yeah, I mean, so these were the kind of things that were happening. And, of course, it angered many people towards me. They became very upset. Attempt to convict me in tribal court with what they call threatening and harassing. Threatening and harassing means that I've said something that you don't agree with. And because many tribal courts, unfortunately, not all, certainly not all, but there are many where the judge and jury, in essence, are hired by the seated legislators or tribal councils or governing bodies. So there's no impartiality. There's no impartiality, right? And so they've attempted to do that to me. They've attempted all sorts of things, but I'm not the only one. I'm not a quote unquote a victim. I don't feel victimized ever. I just don't feel like someone that has an understanding of what victimhood looks like. I just won't buy into that idea of it. I just can't. Because I gotta keep moving forward. I just gotta keep moving forward. And I've seen them break people when they do the law stuff, when they start doing the court stuff towards them, and then people, you know, they disappear from the situation. And I feel bad for them because they are scared. They generally are scared. But the thing is, the way I grew up in the place I grew up in with the kind of father I had, it's kind of hard to rattle you. You know what I mean? like you've pretty much already seen all of it. You know what I mean? You've pretty much already seen all of it. So this, sometimes it comes at you and you're just like, I wish they knew, because I don't want to be the guy saying I'm laughing at you back, because that doesn't help anything. That's not sincere. But I wish they did know and they took the time to understand the reality of my upbringing, so they would know that this probably is not going to have the effect you want it to have. Mm-hmm. But I don't think people take the time, because they're dealing with the majority. They're thinking, well, if this worked on this person, it's going to work on somebody else. You grew up in Detroit. There's things that you can take that other people simply can't take. You know what I mean?
That's true. That's very true.
Yeah, for sure. But they don't have that
object. And I'm not scared to stand up. I'm not scared to speak out, you know, sure. Things like that. And I like to see how they're trying to come about, you know, attacking the families and things like that, because there's always a way to strike back at them. You know, especially when I had Scott Collins on the other day and we talked about eugenics and in Indian country. And it really is true. I mean, all these things about Walter Plecker and changing the birth certificates, he did that with the Virginia tribes, and all the other different states followed suit. And that is customary on the East Coast, to have your birth certificate changed from Indian or you tell them that you're Indian and they put down mulatto or colored or whatever the case was at the time in history.
Sure.
And so Scott and I were talking about not using, you know, they can't use those birth certificates to try to, you know, flaunt in the face of the Indian people and say, oh, you're not Indian because your birth certificate says you're black or you're mulatto or whatever the case may be. And, I've read things about, like, different tribes. They went back and had their birth certificates changed.
Right.
The argument can't
be used anyway, because if you go and you look at some of the seated council members from years past during the whole Cherokee Task Force thing, and people were putting their genealogies all over online, you know, and it was showing that all of their ancestors, even back to their enrolled ancestors, was listed as white on census records.
Mm-hmm.
So for a group like that to then turn around and say, well, you're listed as black or mulatto, it's just silly at that point.
They have no leg to stand on,
especially now in the last couple of years, where it's now people want to connect to communities of color. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. most of it, like I said earlier, in a performative manner, but that's what they want. And so, you know, now they're like, they're really trying to, it says white on my, I got to make sure no one sees that. I just got to put Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma underneath my name on the things I publish and things like that, but not tell the whole story about that. Right. So for me, mm-hmm. I know they've been uncomfortable with me because everything people can read back of mine back into the 90s, I'm already talking about that white privilege. I'm already owning my upbringing, telling you exactly where I come from. There's no story shift. Right. And don't get me wrong. Do I hold all the same opinions that I had in the 1990s as I do in 2021? Absolutely not. Do I grow? Absolutely. But do I change my history? No. I've been from the same place from the beginning. I just didn't know it wasn't cool to claim to not have grown up in an Indian community back then. I didn't realize I wasn't supposed to say that. You know what I'm saying? Like, I was supposed to be saying I grew up with my traditional lifestyle. You know what I mean? Like, this is narrative you keep seeing. Like, there's no such thing as urban people. There's no such thing as, and we know that we make well over 50% of the population in Indian country anyway. But this is like,
exactly.
We're not these conversations. I just don't get it. I've never understood it. I don't know why people do that. You know, it's
that's
like
the reservation versus the urban Indian conflict.
Oh, yeah. It's crazy.
Did you have any questions, Bruce? Did you have any questions for Cedric?
No.
Okay.
Brent said hi.
Did you hear Bruce? He said Brent said hi.
Hey, what's going on, Brent? How are you? Man, it's been so long, you know. I would love to get back up there, and ever since my grandma passed away, we really haven't spent any time up in Canada because she was my real super close link, you know, and and so that was tough when she passed on, for sure. It was definitely tough, and yeah, I think we're all in this, you know, position, you know, of learning at all times. I know I don't have all the answers, that's for sure. I think coming from a mixed community too, it's complex for people. But you know, what's funny is that if you're from a mixed tribal community and you're three affiliated tribes, Mandan, Hidatsa, Rikara, but because they're fairly recognized, there doesn't seem to be a confusion for people. Or if you're Cheyenne and Arapaho from the Cheyenne Arapaho tribe in Oklahoma, which are two tribes amalgamated together, then we're not going to make that an issue. But if you're Mulvan Choctaw that has four different tribal descents in it and non-Indian descent, we're going to make that an issue because you're not fairly recognized, right? So this is what it becomes. Like, now we're going to make this an issue. You know, I've seen people say things like Nanticoke. I've never even heard of that tribe. What kind of made-up thing is that? You don't understand what I'm saying? So now because they haven't heard, they don't know it because they only can list 20 tribes, right? It's like the person that says they love NCAA Division I sports but can only list the 20 in the top 20. They don't realize there's 300 plus NCAA Division I teams playing college basketball, right? So because they don't know that one, they don't know Lamar University in Texas, they couldn't possibly be real, right?
Exactly.
And so it gets crazy, and then now we have over 100 tribes in the U.S. who've disenrolled their own tribal members. As you're well aware, disenrollment's a huge issue down here. So that goes on top of all these issues too. But if you knew the inter-community politics here with the Delawares, people probably wouldn't give them as much power as they're claimed, some of these individuals from the tribe are claiming to have. Because we live here. I mean, it takes me a hop, skip, and a jump to go to the Delaware tribal headquarters here. And the power is, they don't have that kind of power. They don't have that kind of leverage. They just don't.
Well, we've seen some documents circulating on the internet. I can't be for certain about the Anadarko one, but I can be for certain about the Bartlesville document. And it was just stating that, you know, they were going against the corporations posing as indigenous nations. So it's basically, you know, I understand what they're saying. Corporations that have zero affiliate with any tribe, zero affiliate with any Indians, you know, I can understand that. But then, you know, there are tribes that are under the nonprofit status so they could do funding, you know what I mean, to raise funds for the community, and they're state recognized. So they're Indian. Everybody knows they're Indian, and they do get federal dollars. And I was almost to the point of, do these federal tribes know that the state tribes get federal dollars? And, you know, why would they, you know, go after, you know, state tribes and historical tribes? That's what I couldn't get past. Why would they go after these historical tribes when everyone knows that they're Indian?
Well, my, you know, if I can even offer up even a minor answer to it. So the Bartlesville Delawares, as you know, were just a part of the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
So they've always been enrolled with the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma until just recent time. Then they had no status. So they had no federal recognition for a few years. In between them, none. So it's interesting. So what's the first thing someone does when they get admittance to the big boy club after they've been trying for years and years and years? What's the first thing they do? They shut the door behind them. They sleep through the crack, and then they slam it shut. They're the they're the ultimate gatekeepers. I had an individual come to me that was kind of tired of some of the rhetoric when they first put out the fabricated tribes resolution or whatever it was. And this was the Bartlesville Delaware, you know, and they came to me and they literally did this now. And I don't think this is the way we need to go with things, but again, it's just one of those things that there's, you know, there's some wow to it. They held up newspaper, and it showed a Kiwanis Club from the city of all white people. And then they held up a news, a newspaper that showed the Delaware Tribal Council. And they asked me which one is the Kiwanis Club. Well, if you can't tell phenotypically the difference between the two papers, and those are the people calling other people non-Indians, and you know they come from a descendancy-based tribe without a blood quantum, it just doesn't add up.
It's the racial Indian versus the political Indian.
Well, what right? What
and the political Indian? The political Indian was born when they brought in the $5 Indian. That's sure. The political Indian.
Sure.
And
but that's all.
One other thing, Cedric, Bruce was talking about the ceremony, the gatekeeper on the ceremony. We right. are told we're not supposed to have a big house. Bruce wasn't even supposed to have the big house built. And it just, it baffles me. It really baffles me that they would say that. And they attacked his group on Facebook when he first was getting started. With the big house and just talking about meeting to talk about building the big house. And yeah. they infiltrated us. They sent people here that, you know, pretended to be cousins and a part of everything. And they actually were straight traitors and turncoats. And they were just here to basically watch us and to go back and report to them to tell them what we're doing in our big house.
That just it saddens me. It doesn't I think living down here, it doesn't surprise me, but it saddens me. And you know, obviously having been to Moravian Town, obviously knowing these communities intimately well, Moravian Town is where people would go. If you want to be around Delaware people, if you want to be around Lenape people, if you want to be about people who are a cohesive, clearly identifiable, racially identifiable community, then you go to Moravian Town. You don't mm-hmm. necessarily go to Bartlesville, Oklahoma. That's not taking anything away from the people there, but those are different places. They're different places.
Go ahead.
No, I'm not surprised, but it's because I live here and I know how some of these individuals, and one thing we all need to remember is the actions of these people are not the actions of the majority within these communities. These people, any of these people that are going around calling people wannabes and frauds and, you know, all this Indians and all these kind of things, these are not the majority within these communities. But the majority of people are always on the fence because they don't know the issue, and many of them can mm-hmm. be easily influenced. They can be easily influenced because they don't have the historical narrative intact. They don't have the research model intact. They don't really know what this issue is about. But the scariest people tend to be the ones that are just coming into their identity. And so the easiest thing to do is not go out and work in the communities, not work with youth who are victims of sexual violence within our tribal communities, not work with these substantive issues that we need genuinely to address. The easiest work is to go online and to call someone a fake and make themselves mm-hmm. feel, look, I'm a part of this group. See, because I got 20, you know, social media fans, and so many people liked what I just did, you know, gave me the thumbs up, and whatever the case may be. It's a really low functioning way of dealing with things. But in saying that, you know, how many people, when they hear this, that I said it's low functioning, like, who does he think he is? How dare he say this? Da, 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 da. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I just have to say it because I already know I cannot convince anyone any different. We had our website down for 5 years. We just put it back up like 3 months ago or 2 months ago with way mm-hmm. more documentation on it. It doesn't matter how many documents we put there. It's not to prove a point. Those documents are to honor the families that have been involved in that process, and so that they can download things they can contact us. We can give them that. The Haskell Endangered Legacy Project website is not up there to prove points to people. Because mm-hmm. the people that would need to learn the lesson are so entrenched in their ideology, it doesn't matter how many facts are in front of them, they cannot, because they're already ego and narcissism invested in that. Like, there's no way they could ever agree or apologize. It will never happen.
Mm.
And so one of the things I wrote, this was the first thing I wrote, if I can read this, and I'm sorry, I'm, you know, about the length, but.
That's fine.
I started it with the things that I mentioned earlier. The things people use against you in life are the things they most fear themselves. Never has this been truer than with those who have policed identity in Indian country. This chapter addresses the identity policing of those in Indian country who have or are perceived to have some black ancestry. More specifically, it is about white privilege among primarily racially white tribal citizens and how they implement this privilege in highly suspect ways. There are two concepts that everyone must know prior to engaging such discussions. Number one is that much of what the individuals and scenarios discussed in this chapter start from is a place of insecurity and complexity that manifests itself in absolute dishonesty. Number two is that this continual battle over identity in Indian country, which is infused by racism, is not and will never be solved, reconciled, justified, mutually agreed upon, or answered in any way by any opposing parties. If one can understand these key points from the onset, then one is much more likely to view such readings as this is not as oppositional or quote-unquote angry, but rather as simply a discussion infused with realities that has no intention of changing a significant number of minds or correcting a blatant wrong in any manner. In fact, being as open as this chapter is may only serve to cause genuine anger among a segment of its readership with its non-adherence to academic polities and respectability politics, which serves as walls at times to genuine discussion. Even so, it nonetheless must go forward. I don't feel that any of these discussions will translate to reconciliations. The camps are too entrenched.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have one side that engages with sincerity and is the one that this other group is attempting to victimize and still responds in kind with a positive kind message, the other people, they're grappling for things. They don't have genuine status, a lot of them, in their tribal communities. Many of them were not raised within their tribal communities at all, right? And so this is the way they can feel connected. They need this. Like, this mm-hmm. is really, there's a psychosis to it. They need it. Like, this is the thing that makes them feel strong, makes them feel powerful, and they are completely emotionally invested in it. And to dislocate that, they wouldn't have a sense of self-worth. I'll give you an example. I'm teaching in Oklahoma City. You know, I've taught there mm-hmm. in various schools. And so we had these two young officers. We had numerous organized gangs within the school system there, okay? And so some of the teachers were afraid and things of this nature because they weren't from those kind of environs. They were teaching in these environs but didn't grow up in those kind of situations.
Mm-hmm.
So these two young police officers, they get up on stage, they bring in all the staff and the administration there, there's no students there, and they say, hey, we're going to root these gangs out, we're going to rip them out, you don't have to worry about it, and you can literally see people clapping, right? They were so happy that law enforcement was going to come in and deal with this issue. And so I stood up, and I asked the law enforcement there, and I said, respectfully, I want to ask you guys a question. I said, if you're walking in a field with high grass, and there's a big tree in the middle of that field, do you keep walking straight and hit that tree? And they responded, no, you walk around the tree. I said, absolutely you do. No one wants to break their nose walking into a tree. So now you take that tree and you rip it out by its roots and you get rid of it. Well, you still got a field of high grass and you're walking in that same trajectory in that straight line. What ends up happening to you? And everybody's thinking about it. And then someone says, well, you fall in the hole where the tree used to be. And I said, yes, and you break your leg. See, the thing is, in life, you can't just rip something out without replacing it with something positive. The gangs and mm-hmm. the communities where we're at, that's the family unit, because a family unit's not present. And so where is the midnight basketball leagues you're going to put in that tree hole that you just ripped out? Where are the support systems, the counseling? Where's all the things? People are always talking about ripping things out, but what do we replace it with that can be a positive mm-hmm. thing, right? And so that's what happens with these individuals who are identity police. If we just go in there and we just rip them out, they don't have anything else. They're wholly dependent on this dysfunction as the source of moving their lives forward. Like, this is what they have. For the most part, this is the thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's very unhealthy. It's obviously destructive. It takes away from good works they can be doing. But the question for us is, how do we model something that's better for them? How do we model something that's healthy for them? How, when they come and they attack, do we redirect? Because I think all of us want good for people. We don't want to just waste people. We don't want to be those people on the internet when one person posts a comment, all these people say these, you know, silly antics and make jokes of the person and do these kind of things, right? Like, actual educators, actual people who believe in their traditional communities and or who are church people within the community. I mean, the goal for all of us, I think, has always been to try. We want people to be healthy. We want people to be functional.
Mm-hmm.
And that's our goal. And so that's why I'm trying. You know, I'm trying to do my best, and it's hard. I mean, there's even some things I've said in this conversation that could be viewed as a response attack to being attacked or to seeing communities being attacked. But I am trying hard to try to help with that redirection in any way I can or assist. I know help's not a word people want to hear, assist. You know, but it's mm-hmm. tough. It's tough. It's tough when you're when the arrows are being shot at you. The bullets are being,
It is. And one of the things that keeps us going is, you know, having our time. I've been smudging every day with him, and, you know, right. We've been trying to keep the atmosphere at home on the up and up too, right? Because
right.
It helps, especially in Ontario. We're on a lockdown, so that's, you know, we're even
sure.
more inclined to
right.
be viewing and looking and to see what the negativity is. But one of the things that, you know, like I said, is keeping us afloat is being able to have our big house families to talk to them and call them up and say, hey, this is what we're going through over here, you know, and that's it's a support system. So
sure.
we have that. And
right.
we've never closed it off to say that the other Delaware couldn't celebrate with us, because we
right.
want them to celebrate with us and to be
right.
kind and all of that. Because that's what the Creator is expecting of us to do, to be right with one another, not to fight each other and hurt each other and bring each other
right.
down. So, you know, I'm looking forward to good things happening. I'm looking forward to the youth getting involved in helping one another, because that's what we need right now. I don't
right.
see, like, I see the grandparents and the older people coming in and helping and trying to lead the way, because I'm a grandparent, I'm a grandma, and
right.
Bruce is a pop, so, you know,
right.
we want to leave something for the next generations that come after us to, you know, learn and educate themselves, and what better than to have the big house here and be able to teach the children in the big house and to help the children with the big house, because they're learning all kinds of lessons. Like my son Eli, he learned how to chop wood at a very young age so he can keep the fire going inside
right.
the big house. He learned how to help the families pick out their shakers, and my niece would, you know, help with the smudging. Just all of that, all the kids working together. And, you know, because you're raising your children in the big house, and you're going to
right.
ceremony, and you're helping your children understand who they are. And if we don't have those things for our community and for our children and our big house families, I don't know what we're going to leave for them. You know,
right.
I don't see anything positive coming out. That's one of the reasons why we were just really kind of set back when they attacked Bruce about the big house. It's unnecessary. We can all be good to each other. We can be good
Absolutely.
To each other. We know how to
yeah,
do that.
Yeah.
We know how to do it. So,
well, whoever is doing, you know, whoever is doing the attacking, I mean, these are people that don't know this community and really don't know this family. Because, I mean, I know for me and knowing them, those are the Stonefish family, those are the ones you go to. Those are the ones you wouldn't speak against. Those are the ones, if you're trying to learn, those are the ones you're trying to grab a knowledge base. Those are the ones you really want to understand, you know, what being generationally culturally retentive and being a part of a very cohesive community. Those are the people that you would go to. Like, for me, I know them, and it's been many years since I've seen them from not being up there, but the impression, and I knew this to be a fact, as did everyone around us. I mean, they know what they're talking about, and they were humble. They showed humility. They were respectful to people. You know, that's what it always was. And so to me, you know, to hear from them and get a call from them, I'm like, man, that's fantastic. I think my message was, man, you guys must be doing some great stuff now, not knowing about anything that's going on, because they were doing good things. And I know that there's going to be people that gravitate towards what you're doing. I know there's going to be people that can look through whatever, you know, is going on, any of this policing and all these things, and see the truth and, you know, what's going on and how this can be so beneficial to their lives. I firmly believe that. I firmly believe that. You know, I don't see any other way. You know, I'm fortunate next month we get to go down. One of my relatives, she's our cultural coordinator for our cultural center, and she's young, and she's got two young sons, and she's just wonderful. And her and I and a couple of our elders in the community, we get to run one of our summer language camps. And so we're just, you know, so excited about that. And if we were listening to, you know, people say, well, you're from a non-federal tribe, and therefore, you know, even though we do live on a recognized reservation and so forth, we do get settled Indian housing, all these other markers that these people think are meaningful for identity, which they're not cultural or any of these things, right? It's silly. You know, we get this opportunity. If we were listening to people from the outside saying, well, because you're not federal, you can't be teaching your language, a language that's always been present in our community, a language that's never dissipated, it's always been a part of our community. Where would we be now if we're listening to those negative voices? I mean, we would be teaching our kids not to grow up speaking our language. That would be awful. I would feel horrible that I wouldn't be able to live with that. You know, I look at our family, what they've been through. I look at our people, you know, all the boarding schools they were sent to and everything else. And then to turn our backs on them and not to continue what they've done and perpetuated for us because of some people on the internet, that would be awful. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's not like, you know, the East Coast tribes are not fighting back. But we do want to understand exactly what's taking place. You know, and to me, I knew that there were these groups that were out trying to police identity for a long while. I've watched them do, you know, say different things, and I've watched them put different tribes on the spotlight. You know what I mean? And then they even published a list of wannabe Indians or pretendians. There's a list that you could so-called Google. You can go to a Google document, put your email in, and then you can look at the list to see if you know somebody on that list. So,
hey, and I mean this sincerely, not to interject. I mean this sincerely, because there's always been those lists floating around for 20 years. I pray that I am not only on the list, but that I am at the top of it, underlined and bolded. That's where I want to be, because if they're burying me somewhere if they're putting me somewhere in the middle of the list, I'm not a happy camper. I want to be right there at the top, bold, underline, give me an italicized Indian name in the middle, anything. I want the whole package. You know what I mean? That's what I'm looking for. Because if not, I'm going to feel a little bit offended. I'm just saying, and the thing is right now, I'm not even trying to be like sarcastic or trying to, you know, goat them or anything. Like, really, I think that my family, myself, we've worked hard enough. We deserve more of a billing. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like,
well, Cedric, I'm so glad we had this chance to be able to talk to you tonight. It really does make a difference. Every person that stands up and speaks out against this nonsense that's going on in Indian country, and it needs to stop. The gatekeepers need to pack up their bags and roll it away. And no one needs to be insecure about who they are, because even if you're one of the gatekeepers and you don't have that much Indian blood, it doesn't matter, you're still Indian. We still accept you.
Yeah, exactly. Can I finish with a paragraph?
Yes, go ahead.
And I appreciate everything you're saying on that, because people don't have these conversations. Like, no one wants to have this conversation. Everyone wants to act like, I don't want to say it. But, and that doesn't help us either. So I'll put this paragraph that comes from this Indian country's apartheid, the one that got published last year. Lumbee, Moa-Choctaw, Nanticoke, Homa, Ramapo, Halawasaponi, and others have always been Indian country and will always be Indian country. None of these tribes or any individual affiliated with these tribes are leaving Indian country to appease some internet troll or gaming lobby. And what about the people with sincere engagements with Indian country professing a family history of Indian ancestry, no matter how minor, being run off like they are the world's worst offenders for not producing a card? If a white person searching Ancestry.com and finding a singular ancestor on a long ago taken Indian roll can now prance around Indian country with a CDIB, and that happens regularly, while claiming authenticity, then certainly a member of a tribe without CDIBs and whose families generationally attended Indian boarding schools, who are racially discriminated against as brown people, who live their community and traditions and who have always been, should not even be considered for questioning. The first example is what can be referred to as going from social fiction to legal reality. And the second is social reality to legal fiction. That is the current state of tribal identity in Indian country. 20 years from now, the pendulum will swing. Social reality can never be outdone by legal fictions. That's it.
Very good. Yeah, very good. And what was the name of that book again?
So this book here is, let me pull the front up. My section in the anthology is Indian Country's Apartheid. And I'm going to give you all the background on this piece. Let me grab it here.
Okay.
The book is called Otherwise Worlds, Against Settler Colonialism and Anti-Blackness. And it was published by Duke University Press in the summer of 2020.
Okay.
So, yeah.
We can order that book on Amazon.
Yeah, you can get it anywhere. You can get it anywhere. And none of this always becomes the next thing, right? Like, people are making all this money off of writing. Let me tell you how much we make. Zero. There are $0 or pennies for any of these writings. I've written at length in Indian Country Today, Indians.com, lots of different publications, and received $0. So, people, that's how they want to negate words too, as they say people are trying to make money off of these things. This requires a lot of research, and it requires you receive zero compensation in return. What you do receive in return, though, is a powerful feeling of doing the right thing. That's what you get.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. And that's a lot. That's worth a lot more than money. And I don't mean that in a
cliche
way.
Yes, it is.
It's worth a lot more. So.
It definitely
I'm glad
is.
I ran in. I'm very glad I ran into the Stonefish family during a part of my, formation of my own self. I'm glad I ran across many of the Anishinaabe communities in Ontario, as well as the tribes in Virginia and in other places, and met some very sincere, genuine people who explained things to me, gave me an opportunity to ask questions and to listen and to hear things. Gave me an opportunity to make mistakes and find better answers going forward.
Mm-hmm.
All those types of things. Those things matter. And we try to do that as teachers now with our kids. We already know they're going to make mistakes, and we want to give them those opportunities to learn more and have a grow their optics. So that's the goal.
And that's all about life learning, lifelong learning.
Yeah.
I really want to thank you, Cedric, for coming on to the show tonight. Bruce and I really appreciate your words and your understanding and the depth of your understanding with the issue at hand here in Indian Country. And it, and when you break it all down, it all goes back to anti-blackness. So I really want to get that point across to everybody that listens to our podcast. And take notice when, you know, when you go to gatherings and things like that and, you know, check people. You have to use your privilege and stand up and stand up for your brothers and sisters, because one day the bad guy that comes for us is going to be coming for you next, you know, and that's how you have to look at it.
Absolutely. I'm so grateful that y'all connected with me and asked me to be on your show. I'm just really appreciative. Thank you very much for doing that.
Thank you, Cedric. And Bruce, did you have any comments tonight?
I just wanted to say, Kwata Nishik, that was amazing, Cedric. I can listen to you for another 3-4 hours anyway, tonight. That's just the night. So you're very soothing, and you explain everything very, very well, very knowledgeable. I'm so impressed with where you've gone with everything. Very, very impressed. I'm just sitting here in awe.
I appreciate you, and thank you for being a part of us, to stand a part of my, you know, journey early on in my life. You know, it means a lot to me for you to reach out to me, and it just means a lot. I mean that sincerely. It just means a lot. It's really cool to hear from you.
Thank you so much, Cedric. So we're going to end the show now. And, Bruce, did you want to close with a prayer tonight? Okay, just a moment.
Hey, whoa. Pinganal, Kisha Mukwang, Nidishinzi Lilano, Nidalongo Mawak, the Kwachlina Pelwak, Makrodem and Ishnabe, Ninonji, Yonteli, El Napewi Lakawi, Patmose, Nikotimolian, Kiha Kawitkinel, Ngutna Po, Anishik Elmilian, Gutna Po, Wak Walamlaswak and Wak Mitswak, and Nishik Elmilian, Wamba, Ilongo Mati, Wak Wama, Miltawakano. Patumasa Nikutumolian, Kiha Kawichkane, Miluna Bumsina, Wapayane. Anishi. So, thank the Creator, for this day. Thank, for our food, our good health, for our homes, for our families, and for all the gifts. Also ask the Creator if he could be with us at this time as we're trying to walk a white road, a good road, Shachanai, they say, the true road, our true path. So, Anishik.
Okay, and that will be the show for tonight, Cedric. I want, tell you to come back again, because we do want you to come back, and hopefully it will be on better terms, and we'll have good positive things to tell you from this side in the future. Here we're looking. So you guys are going to do a language camp this summer?
Yeah, we'll be doing one here next month, and just really excited about it for the kids. So it's a continual thing we do in the community. And again, I say Chia Kokale to you guys, and as you, a lot of people up there say Miigwech for having me on.
Miigwech, thank you for coming.
All
we'll
right.
talk to you soon, brother. Okay.
See y'all later. Bye.
Bye-bye.